The war is not over in Afghanistan. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Taliban is on the offensive again in Afghanistan, and it's being fueled by the booming market for opium.
The opium bazaar is such that there have been traffic jams, and they are packed now that they are not being interrupted.
Plus, Yemenis feel trapped by war.
There is very little reason for them to stay in Yemen, but also it's extremely difficult for them to get out.
And Leave Your Troubles on Earth Behind, a private company successfully launched and landed a reusable rocket.
This means that space exploration for ordinary people is one step closer, and a big step at that.
Those stories, plus the mountain some Norwegians want to give to Finland, today on The World. It might seem like the war in Afghanistan is over. Most of our troops are back from Afghanistan. Most, but not all. And yesterday there was a tragic reminder of the troops still there when six Americans were killed in a Taliban suicide attack. So no, the war is not over. There are about 10,000 U.S. troops still deployed there. They're training and supporting the Afghan forces, who are now taking the lead in the fight against the Taliban. And that fight is not going well, to be honest. Taliban fighters have been gaining ground lately. This week, we've seen that in Sangin, a district of Helmand province in southern Afghanistan. The Taliban claim they're in control of Sangin, even though the fighting there continues. Another sign that the war in Afghanistan is not over. My colleague Aulia Atrafi with the BBC's Pashto service is in Kabul. He says Helmand is a key target for the Taliban because of the opium that's produced there.
The Taliban have been making progress in Helmand province. I've been speaking to some merchants about the situation on the other side. They say that apart from these war zones where the Taliban are fighting, the bazaars are booming. That also means that the opium markets are booming. So just west of Nadali in the desert, a new Nadali district has sprung up. And the opium bazaar is such that there have been traffic jams. And they are packed now that they are not being interrupted, the same as they were when international forces were operating in this area.
And who's running those opium bazaars and who's profiting from the sales of those poppies?
Well, Taliban are very prominent in taxing and the transportation of the opium trade. And also it's providing a good opportunity for the locals. And that might be one of the reasons why they get the support in the countryside, because the Taliban are encouraging the production of opium.
Would you say the government in Kabul seems to understand how the violence is related to poppy production? And do people have confidence that the government has some strategy to deal with all of this?
I think the government probably does understand the role of opium in this war, but people are losing faith, to be honest. I remember we would be sitting on the banks of River Helmand, and young people would be talking about their future. But now these guys are talking about how to escape, and then they reach the conclusion that they can't really leave the city because they're not single men anymore. They've got families, they've got houses and properties, they've got businesses. I mean, one guy, he spent $600,000 on his house, and he's abandoned that house now. And he went to check recently, and he said that pigeons have been nesting, you know, in the domes of his house, which he decorated with such love and care and spent so much money on.
Aulia, just on a personal note, you fled the rule of the Taliban when they were in power in Kabul in the 1990s. You studied journalism in the UK and seemed determined at one point to really reverse the narratives about Afghanistan that you were seeing in Western media. Do those stories about Afghanistan that once angered you, do they now seem accurate?
That's right. It's very, very frustrating. I think it also explains my odyssey in Afghanistan. So first I started working for a local TV. And when I realized it was too political, I went and I thought perhaps I could serve people better in the civil service. And I became a deputy district governor. And I realized I couldn't serve there either because everything here is working through a chain where you have to take bribe and you have to give bribe. And if you're not willing to become part of that chain, you need to get out of the way because you're disrupting the flow of how things are working. It is extremely frustrating. I think Afghanistan has structural problems, and that is corruption. People in every way of life, whether it's a military or civil service, they have to, you know, give bribe to purchase their jobs, and then they have to take bribe to make that money back. And this all is having a very negative effect on governance, and people are losing hope. And I think that's the main problem with this government.
Aulia Atrafi is with the BBC's Pashto service in Kabul. So a resurgent Taliban, rampant corruption, it's not a pretty picture in Afghanistan 14 years after 9/11 and the U.S. decision to intervene there. And actually, I want to take you back to that time for a few minutes now. Late 2001, a time when few Americans were in the country, and this man was on a mission.
When we had entered Afghanistan, I had been given instructions to accomplish a series of things. Number one was destroy the Taliban because they wouldn't surrender bin Laden. Destroy al-Qaeda as an organization. And then, of course, finally, eliminate bin Laden.
That's Gary Burnson. He was the CIA commander in eastern Afghanistan. And as we just heard, he was on the hunt for al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. Burnson spoke recently to our colleagues at the BBC, recalling the moment when the Taliban regime collapsed in December of 2001.
Bin Laden had fled Kabul. He'd moved along the road in a massive group. There were about 750 to 1,000 people with him. They had moved south to the White Mountains.
That's where the cave and bunker complex of Tora Bora was, near the border with Pakistan. Burnson wanted the U.S. military to move in with a large force immediately.
They had to move very, very quickly. I had made my best case for that. When I realized that I wasn't going to get support for that, I decided to go alone.
Alone actually meant with just a handful of men, four Americans and 10 Afghans. Burnson had them scale a mountain from where they could see the enemy and call in massive airstrikes.
And I did not inform CIA headquarters that I was doing this. I did everything possible to initiate a battle without asking for their permission because I was very concerned that they wouldn't authorize any of it. They would want to know how many people I had. There would have been a slew of questions. I didn't want any questions. I didn't want to hear anything from anybody. And I didn't care if I was fired or relieved either. I was just going to do it.
To provide more muscle, Burnson used his language skills and wads of cash to assemble a local Afghan militia. Then he had these 2,000 or so volunteers attack on the ground.
When you send people off and you are conducting unconventional warfare, there aren't straight battle fronts. It's a confused situation on the ground. You are working with people that are unreliable, and there were times there where I felt that there were some serious disconnects. The largest disconnect, of course, was that with Department of Defense, because I understood that my mission was to kill bin Laden. I'm not sure that everybody in DOD understood that.
Another disconnect was the failure to have Pakistani troops seal the border, and bin Laden ultimately was able to escape into Pakistan. But Burnson believes the battle was worthwhile.
It was, of course, a flawed masterpiece. Part of it was a failure on the part of policymakers to recognize that they needed to shift tactics. But at that last piece, at the end, we needed a larger number of American forces. But the Department of Defense didn't recognize the importance, and all I could do was manage the forces I had to destroy as many members of al-Qaeda as possible. Bin Laden limped out of there. His force was destroyed. It took years to rebuild it. Many of his closest, most capable people died on the ground in our response to 9/11, and many of them died in Tora Bora.
Gary Burnson was CIA field commander in eastern Afghanistan in 2001. He spoke recently with Rebecca Kesby for the BBC program Witness. It's hard to imagine when you look at the ethnic diversity that is New York City, but the city has one of the most racially segregated school districts in the country. Policymakers have spent a lot of time lately talking about what to do about it, so has a class of high school students in the Bronx. Beth Fertig of station WNYC reports that the students are asking some tough questions.
What does diversity mean? This is what some students at the Bronx Academy of Letters are considering as they think about their own school. It's tricky because they're from more than a dozen countries, from Bangladesh to South America. almost entirely Black, Latino, and low-income. So when their teacher asked if Bronx Letters looks like the city as a whole, 11th grader Leslie Cigaron said this.
Honestly, I don't want to sound racist, but I never seen so many white kids in school.
Cigaron is Dominican American, and it's true, there aren't many white kids at her school. Few Asian students, too. Alexis Falcone recalls having just one class with kids of all races in pre-kindergarten.
It was so much diversity, like, between me and other kids. It was like we didn't judge one another based on color. We were just all friendly and, like, we're all... I don't know, I was just... I loved everyone.
These students are now taking a new class on integration in the schools.
This is such an important debate happening in New York City.
English teacher Sarah Camascioli started the class. She says she was spurred to action by a 2014 study by UCLA finding New York State has the most segregated schools in the country.
I felt that some of the greatest stakeholders, the students, I wasn't hearing their voice in the conversation.
Yeah, you got to mix it up so it can be diverse.
Camascioli asks her students to design their own schools and to consider the mix of kids they want from the city's four biggest racial groups.
Like Black, white.
So Black, Latino, white, and...
The kids are learning that racial diversity can have academic benefits and often goes hand in hand with resources. For example, schools in low-income neighborhoods with mostly Black and Latino students are less likely to attract the best teachers. That's why Kenderly Soto says the science teacher in her dream school should have at least a few years' experience.
I guess you don't really need experience to teach something like art, but you would definitely need experience and the knowledge to teach something that we're going to end up taking a Regents for, a test for.
The teacher also asks them how they'd make their classes culturally relevant for diverse groups of students. Abubakar Koma, who's from Guinea, wonders how that would work in a science class.
For science, like, can they have an article talking about different culture, but yes, it's still based on science?
Yes, exactly.
The integration class started last year as an advisory program for just a few of the Bronx students. They visited a public school on the Upper East Side that was mostly white. The students noticed differences right away.
They came back and they said the students are carrying around violins and they have a violin program.
That's Brendan Hernandez, the principal of Bronx Letters. His students asked him why the school in Manhattan served healthier lunch options. Their questions really put him on the spot.
I had to make a decision this year, like, how can I give this resource to our young people? And this year we have a violin program, and we were able to offer it as an elective.
He was able to do that because Bronx Letters has an outside board that raises extra money, though changing lunch menus is a little more complicated. Both Hernandez and Camascioli say they're glad the kids are asking questions because that's how change happens.
We are, like, what is it, 99%? No, 99.9% Black and Latino.
Liz Mary Figueroa Otero says she now realizes it's not good to spend your whole time around people who all look the same.
I don't think that's an easy way of learning because they're going to be so stuck to used to the same people of their own kind, and when they want to go to college or somewhere else, they're going to see different types and they won't know how to react to it.
The class is getting out of its own comfort zone. They plan to meet with students from a predominantly white school in Brooklyn. And at least one of the kids, Shania Russell, testified about the need to change admissions policies at a recent city meeting on education. The 16-year-old says she saw the benefits of diversity firsthand when she studied with a wide mix of kids at a summer writing program.
There was a lot that we learned from each other, and I want it to be like that. I don't want to have to leave to have something like that.
But that's for next semester, when their assignment will be to tackle a problem no mayor or chancellor has been able to solve. How to ensure that every public school better reflects the incredible diversity found on the subways and street corners in New York City. For The World, Beth Fertig, New York.
Coming up, when the perfect gift is a mountain here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Last night, Elon Musk, the entrepreneur and inventor behind the Tesla electric car and the SpaceX rocket missions, tweeted this: "Welcome back, baby. Musk was celebrating the successful return of one of his company's rockets, as in the Falcon 9 rocket that went up in space and then returned safely to Earth, landing vertically on its base just the way it was supposed to. Monica Grady is with me. She teaches planetary sciences at the Open University in the UK. So the SpaceX team in Mission Control were practically dancing on the consoles when the rocket came back. What did all this mean to you?
Well, it's really exciting because this means that space exploration for ordinary people is one step closer and a big step at that. This means that we'll be able to reuse bits of rocket, which means prices will come down. I mean, they're not going to tumble. It's going to be a fair few years yet. But it's really, really exciting that this development has taken place.
Yeah, but even with the prices coming down, I suspect it's still going to be the very, very wealthy who can afford a mission into space.
Indeed, for the first few years, but once it gets to be routine, which might not be for another 50 years or so, but then it will be for ordinary people. I mean, when people first flew across the Atlantic or down to Australia, it was only the very wealthy people who could do that. Now anybody can do it. So eventually it will happen, yes.
Is this the first time a spacecraft has landed successfully in this vertical position?
No. It happened about a month ago as well. Jeff Bezos, who is the founder of Amazon, he has a program called Blue Origin. And they had a much smaller rocket took off from, I believe, West Texas and went up into space, but nowhere near as high as the SpaceX, as the Falcon 9 rocket went up. And it came back down. It didn't go in absolutely into space. It was suborbital. But it is a capsule that's designed to take people into space. So it's really interesting development there as well.
So this represents some changes in the economics of space programs, these commercial space programs. How will SpaceX actually reuse this rocket?
Well, I'm not exactly sure how it will reuse it, but this is a launcher. So this is the bit that carries the business end up into space. So this particular rocket took 11 satellites, and the front end of the rocket was boosted out further into orbit so that the satellites could be deployed. And this is the launcher, the bit that holds all the fuel and all that sort of stuff. So assuming that, you know, there are no problems with the material that it's made from, assuming that it, you know, passes stress tests and all those sort of things, then I don't see that there's any reason why it shouldn't be reused.
Let me put this to you. This was Elon Musk's program. You mentioned Jeff Bezos. Richard Branson is also in this business. Explain to us why you think that ultimately these guys are not just massaging their billions of dollars, not to mention their egos. Do they really, really want out of space exploration to be a democratic thing?
They do. They really, really want to do it. And, you know, they're risk takers. They're picking up a lot of risk, which governments can't do. NASA or the European Space Agency or any other space agency can't possibly start developing space exploration travel for people because they don't have sufficient resource, whereas private companies do have that resource. They have the ability to raise additional funds. They can be more rapid, more flexible. And the three companies you mentioned are all in this race together. You know, it's great that there is this competition because that's the way progress is made.
That's Monica Grady. She teaches planetary sciences at the Open University in the UK. We have no choice but to be back on Earth for this next story. It's about a mountain that could become a gift. In 2017, Finland will be marking 100 years since independence. And to celebrate the centennial, some neighbors in Norway have come up with the idea of giving Finland a mountain. Norwegian Earth scientist Bjørn Geir Harsen was the one who came up with the idea.
If you look at the Finnish situation, they have the highest point in Finland situated in a hillside. And the top of the hill is in Norway, some 150 meters away from the border. And the Norwegian top is about, let's say, 5 meters higher. So it's not very much. Anyway, they have no highest mountain. They have a highest mountain hillside. And I found this already back in 1972 when I was working for the Norwegian Mapping Authority. I was doing some gravity measurements and I flew helicopter and I landed on this special mountain. And I was surprised to see that I was on a mountaintop and I could see some 150 meters down in the hillside, there was the border of Finland. I got the idea that Finland should have a little piece of this mountain, so they have a mountain as the highest point and not the hillside, but I needed to have a good reason. And I found when Finland is going to celebrate 100 years as a free nation in 2017, I thought that would be a good possibility to come up with the idea. So some people picked it up and made a homes page on the internet.
Right.
And I'm really surprised to see how many people who are visiting. We have passed 10,000, and most of them are very positive.
So people on Facebook like the idea. What would actually have to happen in order for this mountain to become part of Finland?
Since it happened to come up on the internet, it has really taken away. I have no control. So I have still to discuss with the Norwegian Mapping Authority. But the little triangle Norway will give to Finland will just be 0.015 square kilometers. And that is so little that it will not make any change on the official square kilometers of any of the two countries.
Yeah, but still, you're essentially asking your government to hand over territory to another country. I mean, if you could speak directly to Norway's leaders, what would you say to convince them?
I wouldn't say that Norway is losing something. We are just adjusting the border a little bit. And we can see from history that the border has been changed, or small changes earlier also. So I problem to see what arguments they should have against it.
Right.
Because I think it would be a very nice gift from the Norwegian people to the people of Finland as a gift in a world when most countries are trying to grab as much as possible from other, and we can show that we really offer a part of the country if it can be of any use for the other part. So it's a very special case. As I said, Finland has no mountain as a highest point. And if we give them this mountain or change the border just a little bit, they will have a mountain as the highest point in Finland. And I think they really, really appreciate it. We really want Finland to get something special when they celebrate their 100 years anniversary.
Well, a mountain would certainly be special. Bjørn Geir Harsen, thank you very much for telling us about this idea.
Yeah, you're welcome.
By the way, in case you didn't know, you can't regift a mountain. You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Luna Mulder grew up in New York and visited her cousins in Nepal during the summers. They were refugees.
They just couldn't imagine what our lives were like in New York. You know, they only had one article of clothing per year.
Now she's a psychologist and helps refugees resettle in the U.S. Her story coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. You could call it a good news story, sort of. A bus full of passengers is traveling from Nairobi, Kenya, to a town in the country's northeast. Islamist gunmen stop the bus and order everyone out. Two people are killed, but here is the silver lining. Many more could have died if not for the actions of Muslim passengers who reportedly protected the Christians on the bus. The gunmen were believed to be members of Al-Shabaab, the extremist group based in neighboring Somalia. My BBC colleague Bashkas Jugsodai is in Nairobi. He spoke with witnesses to piece together what actually happened.
The Al-Shabaab fighters came in and told these people, we are giving you 5 minutes to get outside of the bus, all of you. And they tried, you know, to separate them, to separate the Muslims and the non-Muslims so that they can maybe kill those who are non-Muslims. That was what their intention was, according to the passengers whom I have been speaking to. And they started telling them, okay, those who are Muslims, this side. Those who are not Muslims, this side. And there were some ladies who are non-Muslims. The Muslim ladies gave them some hijab to cover themselves so that it was difficult to identify who is Muslim and who is not. Now, when they came down, the Muslims, they said, no, you are not going to separate us. Whatever you have decided to do, do it to all of us here. Otherwise, we cannot be separated.
What did the attackers do at that point?
At that point, as they were just arguing, there's a lorry it was on a highway. So the lorry came. When they saw the lorry, now the Al-Shabaab fighters started panicking. And there was a driver and two passengers. They asked them to come out. One of the passengers was actually a non-Muslim. They shot him right there. So in the process, also another gentleman who was among the passengers in the bus, also he panicked. He started running. They also shot him.
So, Bashkas, where have you been getting all this information from, all the details, from the passengers?
Yeah, I've been speaking to the passengers. I've been speaking to the employees of that particular bus who are telling me what actually happened. And they told me that after the Al-Shabaab just ran into the bush and disappeared. You remember that last year an attack took place in the same area whereby the non-Muslims were separated from the Muslims and 38 of them were killed right there.
Right. I'm just wondering if you've ever heard of similar instances of defiance when people refuse to.
It hasn't happened, actually. It is the first time that people are trying to resist, these orders coming from Al-Shabaab. And they know the consequence of this. Because right now, as we are speaking, we have almost 2,000 teachers who come from other regions who refuse to go back to work in Northeastern Province.
Because they're worried for their own security?
Of course, they are worried for their security. They have been segregated. They have been killed because of their beliefs. And eventually, the government had to succumb to the pressures coming from those teachers and transfers them elsewhere.
Mm. Well, as we saw with the attack on the college in Garissa back in April, or the 2013 attack on the Westgate Mall in Nairobi, Kenyan police and military were very slow to respond, and many believe the fatalities were higher than should have been because of that. Does this bus story suggest that Kenyans are willing to take their own defense into their own hands because of police incompetence?
Correct. People are somehow, fed up. They are saying to the Al-Shabaab that, we cannot take this anymore. And they are as well sending messages to the Kenya government. Who is their responsibility to protect the Kenyan people?
Bashkas, I need to just ask you one more time, because there's been a lot of speculation among journalists that this story did not really happen the way it's been portrayed, that initial reports were thin on details, and the governor of this area seemed to use the story to burnish the religious tolerance of the region he rules. But apparently he wasn't even in the country. But you stand by the details, yeah?
Yeah, since I have been speaking, to the passengers, one of them, I just spoke to him this morning. He was actually a teacher himself, a Somali teacher who was shot. And he is actually receiving treatment in one of the hospitals in Nairobi.
The BBC's Bashkas Juksodai in Nairobi. Let's turn now to a war that doesn't get much attention here in the U.S., the war in Yemen. In Switzerland last week, the warring parties agreed to a renewable ceasefire, but that has not stopped the fighting. A quick recap of who the warring parties are. On one side, the group known as the Houthis and their military ally, the former dictator of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh. On the other side, the Yemeni president the Houthis toppled, Abdul Rabu Mansur Hadi, not to mention the combined air power of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and they're supported by the U.S. and the U.K. More than 6,000 people have died since the war began, half of them civilians, and most of them were casualties from airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition. Reporter Iona Craig has traveled to Yemen since the war got bigger back in March and has spent several months there. Was there just last month, Iona, I know. Bring us up to speed with these negotiations in Switzerland last week. What came out of those talks, and is a renewable ceasefire better than a regular ceasefire if neither is adhered to?
Well, yes, the idea of a ceasefire is something of a farce, really. Considering the last one never took hold, to say they're now going to renew it seems slightly ridiculous if you look at what's been going on the ground. On the political front, I think the most positive thing to come out of it was the allowance of aid, humanitarian aid, into the city of Taiz, which has been under siege for many months now. When I was there, it was under siege. There was a blockade being imposed by the Houthi Saleh forces, which was preventing food getting in, fuel getting in, and most crucially, medical supplies as well. So I think that was certainly something positive. The rest of it really was just an agreement to meet again in January And it doesn't really look on that basis that we're any closer to reaching any kind of political settlement that is actually going to end this war.
Yemen has no natural resources really to speak of, and the infrastructure, as we speak, is being destroyed. What would the winner of this war actually get?
You're going to get a country in a complete state of collapse. As you already mentioned, the infrastructure has been severely damaged, but you've also got now this huge humanitarian crisis. 21 million people are in need of some form of humanitarian aid. And on top of that, now warring factions on the ground that even if a political deal is reached, it doesn't mean the conflict is actually going to stop. So, yes, I mean, what does winning look like? And if you look at Aden now, which has seen the end of conflict since end of July, beginning of August time, and there is still no state security. You've got assassinations on a regular basis. You've got criminal gangs. You've got carjackings. You've got Islamic State. You've got Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So if that's a reflection of what the rest of the country is going to look like once the war is over, then it's not looking great at the moment.
So given the lack of encouraging news from Yemen, say you get one of your Yemeni friends on the phone, you're in London, what do you say to them?
It's hard, actually, because a lot of people want to get out. They want to get out of the country and they don't have the means to do that. They can't get the visas to do that. They can't escape when they want to, and they want to take their families and they want to get out of there. And I think my concern is how long will people be prepared to hold out as the pressure rises, as we now see the troops and fighting getting closer and closer to Sana'a, for example.
The capital.
Yes, and more people going to try to escape. And if they do, where do they go? And this all contributes to the already major issue of people trying to flee conflict in the region at the moment. And Yemen is now at that point where it's at breaking point. And it's very hard to say to people, don't leave, stay where you are. I mean, when you're sitting here comfortably at home, what reason do they have to stay when they're struggling to keep their families alive and they're facing the growing pressure now of perhaps the capital being engulfed in conflict as well? There is very little reason for them to stay in Yemen, but also it's extremely difficult for them to get out.
Journalist Iona Craig speaking with me from her home just outside London. Iona, thank you very much, as always.
My pleasure. Thank you.
What does the war in Yemen look like? Our colleagues at Global Post sent a reporter and a photographer, and their story has graphic details that support the headline, Yemen is now the world's worst humanitarian crisis. See that now at PRI.org. The total number of new HIV/AIDS cases around the world is declining. That's encouraging. But make no mistake, HIV/AIDS is still a crisis in many countries, like the Philippines, where the number of new cases is actually going up. Aurora Almendral tells us about one man's efforts to help a vulnerable community in Cebu City.
Paul Boncaris is a Catholic monk. During the day, he lives an ascetic life in a Catholic seminary. His nights, though, are spent among sinners. Brother Paul, as everyone here calls him, is 69 and white-haired. He's dressed simply in shorts and flip-flops. When he walks down the pathways of this slum, he's surrounded by half-dressed kids, sex workers on break, and young men with blackened veins and unwashed hair. They call out their pains and ailments. Brother Paul reaches into a ragged nylon bag slung over his shoulder.
In my bag there are condoms here, different types of condoms, and I have my medicines also.
He has acetaminophen and vitamins tied up in little plastic bags. There's amoxicillin for deworming and tubes of ointment for rashes.
There are medicines for sexually transmitted infection.
This neighborhood in downtown Cebu City is notorious for drug use and prostitution. Here, you can buy the cheapest sex or spend about a penny for some floor space at one of the neighborhood's shooting galleries. The ground is littered with used syringes. People share needles.
This is the reason why the increase of HIV, one of the reasons why it's very high increase of HIV in Cebu, because of the sharing of the needles.
The number of people with HIV in the Philippines is still low, about 25,000. That's less than 0.1% of the population. But the World Health Organization is sounding the alarm because of how fast the virus is spreading. About 80% of those with HIV got infected in the past 5 years. But the Philippine health system lost an effective tool when the Senate blocked a pilot program for needle exchange earlier this year on the grounds that it encourages drug use, despite much evidence to the contrary. Health officials fought back, arguing that ending needle distribution would lead to more cases of HIV. They lost. But Brother Paul says you have to keep trying.
I gave 6 packets of condom to the lady.
When he gives condoms to a sex worker, he's doing it in defiance of the highly conservative Philippine Catholic Church. His church. And if he gives an infected drug user a clean needle, he's breaking the law.
We made a decision because we are in the front line. We saw the need.
Brother Paul says the Catholic hierarchy here struggles to reconcile its firm stance against birth control with the urgent need for condoms.
It's easy for them to preach and preach and preach, do not do it, do not do it, do not do it. But for us in the field, when you are with people who are poor and people who are sick and people who are in high-risk situation for sickness, HIV, sexually transmitted infection, and other sicknesses, it was easy for us to decide. So when there are questions coming from the hierarchy, we just do not entertain.
Much of what's contributing to the spread of HIV in the Philippines isn't a lack of information. People here generally know how the infection is spread. The problem is stigma. Discussion about HIV and AIDS is conducted in whispers. Those at risk of contracting HIV avoid getting tested, and those with HIV are reluctant to access health care for fear of what might happen to them if people found out. But Brother Paul offers acceptance.
Is it difficult for you not to judge people for doing drugs and selling sex?
No, I'm used to this one, no. No, it's easier to say no judgment than to judge.
He turns to the drug addict he's chatting with for confirmation. Isn't that right, Brother Paul says? No judgments, no problems. It's when you judge that you run into problems. Right now, the Philippine epidemic is concentrated in specific groups, IV drug users and men who have sex with men. But it's expected to spread. And while the government figures out how to deal with the growing epidemic, Brother Paul continues his nightly distributions, one condom and one clean syringe at a time. For the world, I'm Aurora Almendral, Cebu City, Philippines.
Aurora's story was funded with a travel grant from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Music from the Congolese band Mbongwana Star. Their CD From Kinshasa is one of several that we just loved in 2015. And over the next few days, we'll be featuring the music that hit us this year and, in the words of Bob Marley, made us feel no pain. Some of the best, in our humble opinions, from the last 12 months. So today, it's Mbongwana Star with Un Million C'est Quoi. Mbongwana Star from Congo there, one of my faves from 2015. You are listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. It is official now. The International Organization for Migration says 1 million asylum seekers entered Europe in 2015. It gets you thinking about what it's really like to be a refugee. The World's Jeb Sharp introduces us to a psychologist with a unique perspective on that.
Luna Acharya Mulder came to the U.S. from Bhutan in 1987 when she was just 5 years old. Her father had taken a job at the United Nations in New York. A couple of years later, when they went back to visit, their homeland was in turmoil.
I remember hearing it, but I didn't fully understand it from, you know, a child's point of view. Stories about how they, you know, had destroyed homes and, you know, put schools on fire, and a lot of people were being imprisoned.
Bhutan had begun a violent campaign against its ethnic Nepali population. In the next few years, the government drove more than 100,000 of its own citizens out of the country, including all of Mulder's relatives. She remembers being far away in New York and her parents explaining that her grandparents, aunts and uncles, and cousins were no longer in Bhutan, but in refugee camps in Nepal. One moment from that time sticks out.
We had a framed picture of the former king of Bhutan in our living room, and I distinctly remember my mom and dad taking it down and burning it in the kitchen.
The next time Mulder and her family went to visit relatives back home, they didn't go to Bhutan. They went instead to the refugee camps in Nepal. They found their family members living in terrible conditions.
Very dirty, very hot, 100 plus degrees every single day, and no electricity, no running water, very dirty, very overcrowded. It was just chaos because nobody knew what was going to happen or where they were going to end up.
Mulder spent her childhood going back and forth between her new life in America and summers with her cousins in the camps in Nepal.
They would always ask questions about America, what was America like, and they just couldn't imagine what our lives were like. Had never even seen television, for example, or eaten a slice of pizza, or eaten a piece of candy, or, you know, they only had one article of clothing per year.
Luna and her sisters took little backpacks for the summer with a few skirts and T-shirts each.
And that to them was just like, how can you even wear all those clothes? Why do you need so much for one person?
At the end of each summer, when the family returned to New York, their two-bedroom apartment felt like a mansion.
And to be able to turn a switch and the light would come on, you know, so we didn't have to, like, sit in the dark. Or to be able to go to the bathroom and flush a toilet. So as a child growing up like that, you just grew up feeling very lucky and just appreciating everything that you have.
As the years went by, the camps evolved, schools and shops sprang up. Mulder's aunt ran one that sold pastries, but there was always a sense of uncertainty about the future.
I remember my aunt saying, I don't know what's going to happen to us. Is this it? Like, this is how we're going to live for the rest of our lives?
Looking back, Mulder says she had a unique window onto something she would otherwise not understand. Her two worlds led to a fascination with culture and people and behavior. She ended up studying psychology and getting a PhD. For her dissertation, she interviewed women torture survivors in the camps, trying to understand how the trauma had affected them. Then, in 2008, the first of 60,000 Bhutanese refugees began resettling in the U.S. Mulder, who now lives in Boston, began consulting on cases involving their mental health.
Generally speaking, in the Bhutanese culture, and I think a lot of cultures all over the world, there is no mental health. There are no words, even in the language, that describe words like depression or post-traumatic stress disorder or anxiety. It's very unusual to even talk about problems or struggles with somebody from outside of the family. It's just unheard of.
But Mulder's background made her perfectly suited to help. She knew the language, the culture, the population. She could help American clinicians size up what was happening within a family. She knew that elders were incredibly respected in their own culture and felt lost arriving in a new place, dependent on their children for translation. She could see how teenagers were caught between their new American identities and their heritage. And she could help try to avert misunderstandings over practices like corporal punishment, common back home, but a big red flag here in the U.S.
You know, a parent might hit a kid at home for not listening or doing what they're told, they're setting limits, and the child will go to school, and maybe a teacher will notice something, and the child will say, oh, my mom hit me, but not even thinking anything of it, and then social services comes to the house and takes the children away. And the parents have no idea what's going on, they barely speak any English, and it's just, oh, hold on, and this is very common, and so sad and heartbreaking.
Situations like these underscore the need for education and orientation when newcomers arrive in the U.S., Mulder says the more welcoming we can be, the better these families will adjust. One of the best things we can do, she says, is simply get to know their stories.
Bhutanese refugees in particular, they've never had a voice. Nobody knows their story.
Not quite nobody. Luna Acharya Mulder has been listening her whole life. And since 2008, she's had the satisfaction of watching her own Bhutanese relatives finally leave the camps in Nepal and settle into new lives all over the United States. For The World, Jeb Sharp, Boston.
I'm still thinking about my time in Kenya the past 2 weeks. I was there reporting on women who are owning it in their business or line of work. Now that I'm back, this caught my eye, women who are owning it in the global art scene. The online publication ArtNet News has been tracking this. It's just produced a list of the top 10 female earners in the art world over the past year. And dominating that list is reclusive Japanese artist Yayoi Kusama, whose work has been described as eccentric.
Her works usually incorporate polka dots or will incorporate phalluses in some way. She really, really has this audience now that's with her. There isn't really a female artist who's living or dead, really, that can surpass her besides, you know, Georgia O'Keeffe.
That's ArtNet News Managing Editor Kathleen Massara. Kusama was born in Japan but spent decades in New York, and when she returned to Tokyo in the 1970s, she decided to take up residence in a hospital for the mentally ill, and that's still her home today. If you can't afford Kusama's multi-million dollar art, Massara says, no worries, there's always social media.
Her work is instantly Instagrammable. When she had a retrospective at the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York, in one of her immersion rooms, you walk in and it's this mirrored space that is kind of dedicated to the idea of fireflies. So you walk in and it's just these beautiful twinkling lights all around you. And that became an Instagram sensation.
Also on that list of top earning women artists is Portuguese painter Paula Rego. She sold two paintings at Sotheby's this year for more than $1 million each.
She is known for her dark subject matter, so a lot of times she'll use images from dreams and nightmares. It can be very disturbing subject matter, but also intriguing. You know, it's Freudian, it's dark, mysterious.
Kathleen Massara of ArtNet News there. She had one more observation. She said it used to be that women artists had to wait until they were older, in their 70s and 80s, before investors would buy their work. Male artists sold much earlier in their lives. Now, that's finally starting to change. And that's all from us from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.